Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast. Miljanic and Rankovic. In the previous episode, we looked at the first sledgehammer blow to Yugoslav football in the Planinic affair. But the mid-1960s saw two other controversial figures pushed to the fore. One in how they left the scene, and one who would go on to define the scene for a quarter of a century and would arguably be responsible for all the good and bad that would be associated with Yugoslav football until the end of the nation itself. Let's firstly deal with the person leaving the scene, Aleksandar Rankovic. Rankovic is a name we've come across previously in passing when talking about the history of the nation as a whole. But in the mid-1960s, he had a rapid fall from grace that would echo throughout the nation. Rankovic had been a committed communist since the age of 15 and would move into a fairly high role in SKOJ, the Communist Youth Wing, at only 19 in 1928. He would soon be arrested and put in jail for 6 years, during which he converted most of the inmates to communism. As soon as he was out, he revived the Communist Party in Belgrade, and by the age of 28, was a member of the Yugoslav Politburo. Before there were the partisans, Rankovic was already in a secret location being tortured by the Gestapo, until the partisans rescued him, and Rankovic would go on to set up the intelligence agency of the partisans, and then the intelligence agency of the nation as a whole. Perhaps it is unsurprising that the man in charge of the intelligence service would be one looking for more centralisation throughout the nation, but it put him on one side of two key issues in the young nation. The first was worker self-management, which we've mentioned before on the podcast. The second was Kosovo. Kosovo isn't somewhere we've mentioned too much in the timeline so far, due to it not having played much of a part when it comes to football. But, as today, it contained a large Albanian population who were not overly keen on the concept of a Yugoslavia that was, in essence, a different ethnic group to them entirely. As mentioned in a previous episode, Rankovic's intelligence agency had files and surveillance on a quite incredible portion of Kosovars, and, at the start of the state, Rankovic was given autonomy by Tito to bring Kosovo to heel. Rankovic also hated Albanians and, by extensions, Kosovars. Making things worse after the Tito-Stalin split was that neighbouring Albania were very much in the Soviet camp. So Kosovars were essentially purged, with Stalinism acting as a convenient excuse for what was essentially an ethnically based crackdown. After the Second World War, Kosovo remained in a state of emergency until 1966. No other area of Yugoslavia remained in a state of emergency post-war beyond 1948. The result of this was twofold. Firstly, a marked upswing in migration from Kosovo to Albania or Turkey, with Serbs and Montenegrins moving in. The second was that Rankovic's relatively Serb nationalist policies in Kosovo got the backs up of those who were part of the intelligence agency looking after the north of the state, and it's those enemies who would bring about his downfall. As intelligence agencies tend to do, Rankovic had senior members of the Communist Party bugged. And, as intelligence agencies tend to do, Rankovic had authorised the evidence found from that surveillance to be used against those people. It was just the excuse that his enemies needed to claim that Rankovic had bugged Tito himself. Whatever the truth of that allegation, because no one really does actually know for sure, the reality was that Rankovic was at the very least a direct threat to Tito, given how much he had compromised those around him. Rankovic, and those seen to have collaborated with him, were expelled from the Communist Party in July 1966, but not prosecuted, given the large potential risks of putting a man who had the dirt on virtually every member of the Yugoslav hierarchy on trial under oath, where he could spill said dirt. Brankovic, to his credit, retired quietly and kept a low profile until his death in 1983. But it would be wrong to think that this is where Rankovic's story ends, because of what Rankovic represented. Firstly, the fall of Rankovic represented the end of there being any major opposition to the decentralisation of Yugoslavia. He had had the ear of Tito, and after his fall, no major pro-centralisation figure would rise, or at least none would rise to the far-reaching influence that Rankovic had. Secondly, hand in hand with the fall of Rankovic was the loosening of the tight rein that had been held over Kosovo. In doing so, this irritated Serbs who felt that Kosovo was Serbia. While the jury is actually out as to whether Rankovic himself was actually a Serb nationalist or just a Yugoslavist who really disliked certain ethnic minorities, because Kosovars were not the only minority his agency persecuted. Given that Rankovic had overseen the importation of Serbs into Kosovo, it was understandable why Serbs would feel insulted. As such, the expulsion of Rankovic had created a Serb nationalist icon, and one that, on his death, would see over 100,000 people attend his funeral and turn it into a nationalist demonstration. A politician who most in the Yugoslav hierarchy had thought was forgotten in the 17 years between his fall and his death, became the man who lit one of the fires that would lead to the fall of the nation, and one whose policies in Kosovo create dispute to this day. So, with one controversial figure down, it's time to move to the other one. But to enable us to do so, it's time to take a look at what happened with the national team after the 1962 World Cup. Between 1961 and 1965, the multi-coach system the nation employed whittled down to the point where the sole coach became Ljubomir Lovrić. As the management team whittled down, so too did the standard of the side. 1962 rounded out with merely okay results, a draw in Leipzig against East Germany before a loss in Zagreb to West Germany, slotted around merely okay results against other sides. As 62 turned to 63, attention turned to qualifying for Euro 64. A tight two-legged win over Belgium, topped off by a 1-0 win in Brussels courtesy of a Galic goal, was followed by a tie against Sweden. Sweden were outsiders given that they hadn't gone to Chile, and that the side that had put them out in qualifying for 1962, Switzerland, had done absolutely nothing once they had gotten to Chile. However, the Swedes held the Yugoslavs at the JNA before winning in Malmo to knock Yugoslavia out. As if to point out just how big a disappointment this was, one of the teams that went into the round beyond this were Luxembourg. In the space of a year, Yugoslavia had gone from one of the world's best to also-rans. Pioslav Mihailovic left the coaching setup, and Yugoslavia would operate with two coaches. Results did pick up for a short while. A pair of wins both home and away against the Czechs would show Yugoslavia's quality, while a similar pair of wins over Bulgaria with experimental sides would show the depth the nation had leading into the beginning of World Cup qualification. In amongst all this, Yugoslavia faced off with a rest of Europe team in a friendly game to raise money for earthquake relief for Skopje. The opponents included Lev Yashin, Josef Mashopust, Uwe Seeler, and Portuguese stars Chamois, Jose Augusto, and the incomparable Eusebio, who would score four on the night as Europe won 7-2. Next was a trip to Japan for the 1964 Olympics. Having only ever been in finals prior to this since the end of World War II, expectations were high, especially as Yugoslavia took a fairly experienced side with Rudi Bellin, Pajo Samardžić, and Slaven Zambata coming along. It did not help, nor did going down to one head coach in Ljubomir Lovric. The 1964 Olympic football tournament was, however, held under a cloud. In a decisive South American qualifier between Peru and Argentina, disaster struck. With 6 minutes to go at the Estadio Nacional, a goal for Peru that would have equalised the game was disallowed, controversially. Home fans stormed the pitch, and police responded by firing tear gas into the stands. At the ground, instead of gates, shutters were installed at entrances and closed during the game itself. As the crowd panicked to escape the tear gas, they found the shutters down and exits blocked. Those following them could not see the blockage, so there was a crush to the point at which the shutters burst. At least 328 people were killed in the crush. However, it was followed by rioting in the streets, and an unknown amount of people were killed by gunfire. However, no deaths were ever officially attributed to that, as a cover-up from the government took place. When it came to the action in Japan, qualification from the groups was easy enough. North Korea had qualified for the group, but withdrew as some players were banned from travelling to Japan, meaning that two of Yugoslavia, Hungary, and Minos Morocco would qualify. Hungary confirmed Morocco's Minos status by hammering them 6-0, with every goal scored by French Benet. Yugoslavia followed that up with a 3-1 win over the North Africans after going behind in the second minute. It set up a group decider against the Hungarians, which finished 6-5 to Hungary after the game was 4-4 after only 35 minutes. For Hungary, Tibor Csernai smashed 4 home, while Ivica Osim and Rudi Bellin both scored doubles for Yugoslavia. The result for Yugoslavia was a quarter-final tie against Germany. By name, the side was meant to be representing a united Germany, but in reality, it was just East Germany. A first-minute goal from Henning Frenzel was enough to take the East Germans through and mean that for the first time since 1948, the Olympics would have a final without Yugoslavia in it, as Hungary went on to win the tournament in a final win over Czechoslovakia. Yugoslavia fell into a repêchage of sorts, defeating Japan 6-1 before losing 3-0 to Romania in the fifth place playoff. And no, I have no idea why that would exist either. This is the last time we'll have cause to go to the Olympics until 1980. In the intervening three editions, they will continue to be dominated by communist nations. To give each a very quick overview, 1968 saw Hungary win, Japan become the first Asian nation to medal at football, getting bronze, and Morocco withdraw after refusing to play Israel as the games themselves played host to lots of civil rights issues, not least related to the hosts of the games, Mexico. Poland won in 1972 in Munich as the bronze medal was shared after a 2-2 draw between the USSR and East Germany in a game that was completely and utterly fixed. While the whole games themselves were overshadowed, of course, by the Munich massacre. East Germany got gold in 1976 in a tournament boycotted by all African sides in apartheid-related issues, while the East German coaches dumped all of their leftover performance-enhancing drugs in a Montreal river, and the Olympic flame itself would be put out by rain and had to be relit with an official's cigarette lighter. Not really a golden era for the Games. 1964 ended with no more wins for Yugoslavia and in a coaching change. Back came Aleksandar Tijanić to share the job once more, this time with, he's here, Miljan Miljanic. 1965 started well with a win over France at the Maracanã and drawing against England there also. However, a 3-0 loss in Oslo was fatal to Yugoslavia's hopes of qualifying for the 1966 World Cup. When it was followed by a 1-0 loss to France at the Parc des Princes, Yugoslavia were eliminated. Tijanić and Miljanic would hang around until the end of 1966 looking after the national side before Rajko Mitic would take over in 1967. The 1966 World Cup would simply go on without them, and as a Scot, I can confirm that absolutely nothing of any importance happened there. Anyway, having brought his name into the timeline properly, it's time to properly talk about Miljan Miljanic before launching into him being part of the timeline, as the impact he has on the game will be greater than to merely go on about him in a profile episode. Why is that? The best explanation I can come up with comes from growing up in and around horse racing. There, the true value of a stallion isn't in being a sire, it's in being a sire of sires. You don't just produce high class yourself, you produce high class that produces high class. Miljanic was not just a massively successful coach, he was a massively successful coach who provided a template for coaches over the next few decades to follow on from him. Some, like Ciro Blažević inside Yugoslavia, some, like Vicente del Bosque, outside. Many direct acclaim for the reign of Liverpool in the mid-70s down to the lessons Miljanic's Zvezda taught them on the park. In terms of honours, few could ever deny the success it brought. In terms of everything else, many would argue that more or less every negative trait between here and the end of Yugoslavia can be traced directly to Miljanic. Here was a manager who didn't naturally play positive football, but it didn't matter because it was football that got results. Here was a manager who won La Liga twice, managing Real Madrid, but did it playing direct football with much of the possession in defence, as, more than anything, Miljanic was a pragmatist who wasn't about to let the niceties of having quick attacking football get in the way of winning a game. He had players and sides who were perfectly capable of enchanting viewers, but only when the task demanded it. To the point at which we're at in the timeline now, Miljanic's life had seen him born in Bitola in North Macedonia, to a Montenegrin family of the Banjani tribe. As a Miljanic, we know the family would have originated from around the current border between Montenegro and Croatia. The family remained there until World War II hit, when they became refugees, and the family escaped to Kragujevac, where aged only 14, Miljanic would join the partisans. Come the end of the war, the family moved to Belgrade, where Miljanic would join the youth ranks of Crvena Zvezda, and go through an undistinguished career as a defender, with only one senior appearance, and spent his time studying economics and psychology, taking over Zvezda's youth teams. Miljanic would prove to have an incredible mind for coaching. In terms of moving football into more modern times, he worked methodically on fitness. When he joined Real Madrid, he placed in two coaching demands. Firstly, that he'd be allowed to bring his fitness coach from Zvezda with him, and secondly, that the side move from one training session a day to three. As we're going to leave him at the end of this episode, Miljanic is just becoming Sven's Fiesta manager, and he's just about to get his hands on Dragan Zajec. By the end of our timeline, he will have had multiple spells as national team manager and 2 decades at the head of the Yugoslav FA, directing football in the dugout or the boardroom for the best part of 40 years. Those 4 decades would see some incredible footballers, but would also see the growth of negative football, as Miljanic's pragmatism spread and was, in part, lost in translation, as teams fell back into defensive and often brutal football that would, in one sense, presage what we would see in football in the rest of Europe as we headed into the late 80s and early 1990s, and, in another, show how poor those tactics were in advance of them being more thoroughly debunked. But all of that is some way off, because while we drop Miljanic off neatly at the time of taking over Sven's Fiesta, we've yet to get to that point when looking at the domestic scene, and that's where we're going next, because next time on the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, the ramifications of the Planinic affair will play out. Partizan will reach their highest height, and for the first time, the Big Four won't have things all to themselves. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll catch you next time.